So for something completely different now, it's a sort of report from the trench lines of empirical research on male-female differences. That's at least how it started. I end a little bit differently. And I also, I had a lot of material and I had to cut it down to fit the time slot. So now it's cut down to really to the bare bones without any flesh. So I hope in the discussion maybe I can put again some flesh in a detail or bring more detail into it. Under the title you see the three parts of my presentation. First I'm going to say a very few words on contemporary research. Then the middle part of my talk is on nature-nurture dualism, and I end with some Heideggerian reflections. I wanted to comment in the discussion just before, after Christine's talk, but I'll have my point now. Okay. In the past, over the past decade or so, we have heard a lot about male-female differences in cognition and behavior. There are basically three major fields of research which make claims about male-female differences, and that's neuroscience, evolutionary psychology, and social science research. Now, obviously, there's a lot to say about each of these fields, but I'm going to restrict myself to mentioning only some features of evolutionary psychology and social science research, some features that are relevant for my argument. Research in these two fields mostly combine statistical methods with an explanatory approach. And that's basically nature explanations in the case of evolutionary psychology, and social constructionist ones in the case of social science research, mostly. The classical cognitivist paradigm seems to be the dominant paradigm for both. This is very clearly the case in evolutionary psychology, less so in social constructionist theory, but I believe it's tacitly assumed there as well. And classical cognitivism I define here simply as the view of the mind or the brain as an information processing device which is connected but not constituted or co-constituted by the situated body. Now, the explanatory approach of the two fields of evolutionary psychology and social constructionist theory can be summarized by way of the causal chains they theorize. That's in evolutionary psychology, the causal chain starts in the environment of evolutionary adaptation, the EEA, is the acronym they use, and that's the Pleistocene period, Stone Age, during which supposedly the genes of modern humans were selected. These genes then built brains, that's the metaphor often used by evolutionary psychologists. These genes built brains containing many specialized modules, including modules for male and female behavior. Now, male-female differentiation of the brain and hence of behavior caused by male and female brains or modules is explained mainly by the parental investment theory of Trivers, which says that the selection pressures of male and female mammals differ because of asymmetrical parental investment, that is, a much greater investment by females. And then the asymmetry is then hypothesized to produce male-female differences in so-called mating behavior, and it's a term evolutionary psychologists like to use, mating behavior, and then most prominently, most famously or infamously, sexual possessiveness and promiscuity in men, and choosy or careful mating behavior in women, and monogamy or serial monogamy in women. Social constructionist theories, the causal chain consists really of input-output relations with the brain as a black box. Unlike evolutionary psychology, there is no theorizing about the brain, about the mind in social constructionist theories. They look at input, that is differentiation and nurture, like for instance a famous topic is male-female labor division, and then they correlate it to output, which is that male-female differentiation in cognition and behavior. As I said before, the classical cognitivist paradigm is tacitly assumed here, as far as I can tell. I talked with a couple of researchers, and basically they never heard even of embedded embodied cognition, or it seemed that they basically the 1950s, 1960s cognitivist paradigm was still in place for them, but they weren't doing anything with it. Now to the second part of my talk. As Susan Oyama explained already more than 10 years ago, everybody is an interactionist nowadays. Also, evolutionary psychologists and social constructionist researchers believe that dualism is wrong and should be replaced by interaction of natural and social factors. They only mainly fight over the numbers. How much of the male-female differences is caused by nature, how much is caused by nurture. Now, this kind of interactionism presupposes Cartesian ontology of two neatly separated domains with their own ontological features. And this presupposition is exemplified by several features of their studies. I'll review two very shortly, and that's the dualist conception of nature and nurture and the binarity assumption. Evolutionary psychologists and social constructionist researchers have a lot in common, much more than they seem to realize themselves. Crucial in this context is that they are in complete agreement about how to sort, as it were, the supposed nature and nurture causes of male-female differences in behavior. They agree that universality of behavioral male-female differences is evidence of evolved human nature, and hence points to natural causes, whereas variability testifies to social and cultural causes. In short, they agree that human nature is universal and enduring, while society and culture change over time and are plural. Now, these conceptions of nature and nurture are, to put it simply and bluntly, are false. As a species, human beings do indeed share universal traits, like upright posture, the way I'm standing here. We share with other mammals. For instance, important features of our reproduction. But as developmental system theorists point out, evolutionary selection is not about genes which lay down a causal blueprint of human nature for millennia to come, which is basically the theory evolutionary psychologists work with. It is about the life cycle of the organism in its eco-social embeddedness. Developmental systems theory and related theories falsify the idea of human nature as simply universal and unchanging or enduring over ages and ages. Likewise, it makes little sense to equate society and culture with changing variability. Take, for instance, language and art. As typical features of human cultures and societies, they are as universal and enduring as they are diverse and changing. There's obviously a lot more to say about this. I have a nice quote from Emily Clark here too, but I'll skip it. times take, and I go to the second issue, the binarity assumption. In social constructionist and evolutionary psychology research, there is little to no awareness of the fact that binarity I simply define as classifying people as either male or female, man or woman, that this binarity classification is questionable. The only features of human beings that can be reliably sexed in a binary way are actually genitals. Mostly everything else, chromosomes, hormones, brains, behavior, are increasingly difficult, and in the case of behavior and cognition, next to impossible to reliably sex in this way, in this binary fashion. Often quoted, supposedly reliable male-female differences, such as in mathematics performance and in verbal behavior and in relational aggression, these differences that are quoted so often as reliable, they don't hold up in meta-analysis or show so much overlap between men and women and so much variation within the two groups that the scientific validity of male-female binarity is at stake, seriously at stake, I would say. So, why is the binary classification so self-evident to these researchers that it's not at all questioned, not even when, for decades now really, the evidence for behavioral male-female differences actually points in the other way? That is because, I submit, the biological sex is assumed to be simply binary, and binary biological sex is privileged as causal determinant. The unwarranted causal privilege of binary biological sex derives from the same dualist model I showed before, and I show now again, only now with the ontological features of the causes added. Natural causes are considered overriding, and treated at least as thus, and this by both the evolutionary psychologist and the social constructionist. Natural causes are overriding because they don't change, and apparently are supposedly they have universal application, whereas social causes are subordinate because they change a lot and they have limited application. That's the implicit reasoning I reconstruct, because I haven't found this explicitly. I simply always find this differentiation in the empirical studies. Now to the last part of my presentation. Now, though I'm confident that this type of, let's call it, interactionist dualism, or dualist interactionism, will in time be replaced by the promising post-dualist approaches that have been developing over at least 20 years, I think, by now. The promising post-dualist approaches of embedded embodied cognition in its many varieties, including extended, etc. Developmental systems theory, also feminist materialism that has gained a lot of attention over the past 5 to 10 years, I think. So, despite the fact that I think that will be the direction in which eventually also these empirical researchers will move, although it might take quite a long time, and I find these post-dualist approaches very promising, I still want to finish on with some critical comments on these post-dualist approaches. I have some Heidegger, here he is again, some Heidegger-inspired doubts on the naturalist commitment that most contemporary post-dualist approaches appear to share, I think this is definitely the case in embedded embodied cognition in its in most of its varieties. The minimal naturalist consensus that many post-dualist approaches seem to share involves an ontological and an epistemological commitment. The ontological commitment amounts to the claim that, in the words of Michael Wheeler in the 2005 book, there is ultimately nothing but physical stuff. The epistemological commitment involves the privileging of an explanatory approach. From a Heideggerian point of view, both commitments are problematic. And for time's sake, I'll skip the ontological commitment and focus on the explanatory approach, on the epistemological commitment, and say something about that. Maybe in the discussion we come back to the ontological commitment. Now, the exclusive use of explanatory approaches may preempt an adequate understanding of the explanandum, the reason why Heidegger in Being and Time was capable of a post-dualist and non-representationalist account, which is recognized quite broadly now by the embedded embodied cognition extended, etc. community, as far as I can tell. The reason why he succeeded in a post-dualist and non-representationalist account is because, mainly, at least I would submit this, he employed a hermeneutic phenomenological approach to ontology and not an explanatory one. Never, ever he does use an explanatory approach, Heidegger. And very clearly, he always uses a hermeneutic phenomenological approach. So what does that involve? Again, very briefly, Heidegger starts his phenomenological analysis with a careful explanation of the usual understanding of a phenomenon, the everyday understanding of a phenomenon. You could maybe say, in terminology that is used quite a lot in the UK or by people with a background in analytical philosophy, the folk psychological understanding of a phenomenon. And whether the phenomenon in question is a hammer, or the self, or even truth. In Being and Time, these are important steps, as it were, in the analysis. With truth and the self, he does the same as with the analysis of the use of a hammer. He starts with what happens in everyday life and an everyday understanding. Now, because everyday understanding may be informed by misleading categories, and that's common sense categories, but also because mostly the step Heidegger makes is that he deconstructs the misleading common sense categories by then pointing where they come from, and that's misleading philosophical categories. So, because everyday understanding may be informed by misleading categories, common sense ones and philosophical ones and even scientific ones, although that doesn't figure very big in Heidegger. The second step of his analysis typically consists in deconstructing these misleading categories. The point of the hermeneutic phenomenological approach is to get a better, fuller sense of the phenomenon in question, nothing more and nothing less. And that is, in the case of Heidegger, an understanding that tries to suspend the fallacious assumptions of substance ontology, or substance metaphysics, if you will, and epistemological dualism. As it focuses on explaining the cause of the explanandum, an explanatory approach is not very helpful when one tries to understand the meaning of the explanandum. Lack of adequate understanding of the explanandum, however, increases the risk of unwittingly re-inscribing over and over again misleading categories. I think the explanatory accounts of male-female difference that are widely in use in empirical research right now are a case in point. Instead of taking a closer look at and gaining a more detailed understanding of the explanandum, the validity of male-female binarity is simply assumed in studies on behavioral variance, on behavioral differences. Moreover, the design of these studies does not allow for a critical examination of the common sense understanding of male-female differences, which is typically binary and riddled with stereotypes. Instead, this understanding unwittingly guides the definitions and measures of these studies, with the result that they tend to recycle the common binary stereotypes. In fact, almost unfailingly, I must say, at least I've reviewed a lot of studies and it happens over and over again. Now, to sum up, the point of the hermeneutic phenomenological approach is not to replace the explanatory approach, but to get a better sense of the explanandum before one tries to explain it. On the whole, nothing would be lost and a lot might be gained when the explanatory approach of the new post-dualist theories would be supplemented by careful hermeneutic phenomenological examination of the explanandum. And in fact, there are people who are doing this work. Especially, I think Sean Gallagher and Dan Zahavi are doing fine work in this direction. Because however sophisticated they may be, no explanatory theories and scientific methods can ever make up for a lack of understanding of the phenomenon you wish to explain. Thank you.